Hi, this is Jim Rossi, and I'm here today with Professor J.B. Rule, who's the David Daniels Allen Distinguished Chair of Law at Vanderbilt University Law School, where he also directs the Program on Law and Innovation and is co-director of the Energy, Environment, and Land Use Program. Professor Rule, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for asking me to join you, Jim.
And Professor Rule has authored an article recently with James Saltzman, one of many, but this article in particular is entitled What Happens When the Green New Deal Meets the Old Green Laws, forthcoming in Vermont Law Review. And this article is going to be the subject of our conversation today. Professor Rule, to kick things off, could you describe for us what you mean by the Make America Green at Last agenda and how the Green New Deal fits into this?
Sure. So, of course, the article, the title of the article suggests what it's about. It's taking the Green New Deal and sort of putting it up against existing environmental and siting laws and asking, you know, how is this going to work? And so we start the article off with a kind of a hypothetical presidential election debate. The question is to the two candidates, you know, what's your vision for the infrastructure of America? And one vision is probably business as usual, sort of make America secure again. We're going to, you know, build out pipelines and roads and seawalls. And the other one is make America green at last. And if you read the Green New Deal resolution, it's a combination of a very progressive vision of America's energy profile and environmental profile, but also a very progressive view of distributive justice and participatory democracy in implementing that new agenda. So it's kind of a subtle but intentional reference to Martin Luther King's, you know, free at last, but also green, right? So and that's really what the Green New Deal is about, I think. It's taking the combination of social justice, but also green energy and other policies and putting them into one big package.
Excellent. And your article is really focusing on the possibility of a collision course of sorts between the old green laws, right, and the Green New Deal. To begin, if you think about the Green New Deal, how would the 100% renewable or maybe high renewables energy scenario envisioned by some of the transitions towards the Green New Deal, how would this have adverse impacts on the environment?
Well, sure. So green energy, whether it's solar, wind, is not necessarily environmentally neutral. Certainly, it's green in the sense that it reduces carbon emissions. That's the overriding goal. But it takes up space. It takes up habitat. The minerals needed to construct wind turbines and solar panels require mining rare earth minerals. The electric transmission lines that will be needed to connect the new infrastructure to the grid will cut through habitat near neighborhoods. Wind turbines kill birds and bats. Solar panels take up valuable habitat space. So they're not environmentally neutral. They have their own environmental degradation impacts. And that's clearly something that engages existing environmental laws and should.
And one of the examples you discuss in the article, which I know you have a lot of personal familiarity with, is the transition to wind energy in Texas. This transition has been pretty remarkable, and it didn't face these barriers to the same degree maybe that some other projects have. Why was this successful? What worked in Texas in helping the transition to wind along?
Texas' experience was perhaps unique in the United States in the sense that the Texas main thrust there was to facilitate the generation of wind power, the new wind power, by creating the electrical transmission lines needed to move it from North Texas, where the wind is very suitable for wind power generation, to the populated areas of Texas. I think they were able to install 3,600 miles of transmission line in a relatively short time frame. And part of there was a combination of factors, really. Texas, its grid is separate from the national grid, so they're not subject to Federal Energy Regulatory Commission rate regulation. Internally, Texas basically gave the Public Utility Commission sort of a free hand to run this program, and they took a very streamlined, rapid approach, which may have rankled some environmentalists and property rights advocates, and it did. On the other hand, they were able to do this in fairly rapid time, and Texas is now generating tremendous amounts of wind energy.
And an interesting contrast to this is the Cape Wind Project, which now has been almost decades, I believe, in the making. Why has that project just not gotten off the ground in contrast?
So Cape Wind, is, as you know, is an offshore wind generation facility off of Nantucket. It required federal, state, and local approvals. I think people don't realize that just putting wind power offshore doesn't mean that you're done with the permitting and the infrastructure. You have to get the power onto land, and they had a number of permits they needed from local governments and state government. And so it became a permitting quagmire. And these permits allow affected interests to intervene, to challenge approvals, environmental assessments, and that's basically what happened. They just got ground down by endless litigation, and it took 18 years to go from proposal to pulling the plug, so to speak, and the project is essentially dead.
So when you contrast what's happened in Texas to what's happened with Cape Wind, in Texas you had a more streamlined approach, as you pointed out. Should we, in regulating these kinds of new generation clean energy projects, should we give a green pass to these kinds of projects if they're likely to have low carbon impacts? And if the energy infrastructure that's being built is going to have a lower carbon impact over its life cycle or at the back end, should we give it more of a pass, a green pass, at the front end?
Sure. Well, as we point out in the article, certainly green infrastructure has no green pass at present under existing laws. So the question is, do you just give it a green pass, which is, that's, renewable energy, so don't worry about this. No, of course not. But is the right response just a tweak here and a tweak here, there, an existing environmental law to streamline, as the term of art is used? And we don't think that's either the right approach or even an effective approach. So streamlining generally has been the sort of a term of art for let's ease off, right? We're not proposing that at all, but we do think that we have to come up with a new way, not just applying the existing old green laws or tweaking them, but a completely new way of thinking about how when we identify a project like massive wind power facilities, we'll need lots of them. Solar facilities, we'll need lots of them. Putting solar on rooftops, electric transmission lines, all of that. Is there a new way that we can facilitate their siting, but also be attentive to the Green New Deal's goals of democratized participation, social justice, recognizing that, in the past, the transmission line, the pipeline often went near low-income and vulnerable populations. So that's the question. We don't have the answer in the article. We're just posing that as we really realistically have to come up with a new way of facilitating this particular kind of green infrastructure.
You've written about complexity in some of your scholarship, some really influential scholarship on complexity, and I wonder whether another way of saying what you are bringing attention to in the article is that we need to recognize the complexity of the problem, and we might do so by looking at the net environmental and societal impacts on a system basis, maybe over time, over the life cycle of an energy infrastructure project. If you do that, I think you can take into account all these different societal goals related to the climate transition, fairness and distribution goals, as well as carbon reduction goals. Doesn't existing law allow that, and why doesn't it happen?
The problem is that when we say we're going to reduce emissions, essentially we need to get to net zero by 2050 and reduce by 50% by 2030. These are amazing system-wide propositions. But our actual infrastructure system is highly disaggregated, right? So we're trying to solve a system-wide climate problem, with a wind facility in Texas here, a solar facility in Nevada here, some transmission lines from Utah to California here. So it's very disaggregated. It's not a systemic approach to placing this infrastructure on the ground. So how do we develop a system approach, even if it has to be implemented, state by state or project by project? is there a better way to do this than these three states are pursuing this project, this state here, this private company there? So it's the problem is matching the system problem of climate change with our system of placing infrastructure on the ground.
One of the things you also highlight in the article is that apart from the regulatory disaggregation that you just described, environmental protection interests, NGOs, and the like, have themselves sometimes compounded the adoption of renewable energy by imposing demanding conditions on projects. Could you give an example of this?
Well, yeah, so, I mean, as a general matter, our friend David Spence, in a recent article, identified some sort of splits between national environmental NGOs who are, they're taking a system-wide approach to it, right? And local NGOs who may be demanding a higher standard of environmental impact, or basically they're NIMBY.
And they become anti-wind or anti-solar in their general policy agenda, mitigation strategy.
Right. So, in fact, I had a personal involvement in a case in which a local organization was trying to not stop, but they were contesting the approval of a wind generation facility because it was going to, and all agreed, it would take or kill up to 26 bats over 5 years. Even though mitigation efforts to deal with the other problems the bat was having were recognized by all to offset that impact. This group was sort of a, you know, take no bats approach, and the only way to do that, at least under current technology, was to sacrifice some of the wind generation capacity of the facility. So this kind of short-term, long-term, I think the national NGOs are taking a longer-term view, but you find smaller local NGOs taking more of a short-term view. You know, what's the impact on my property value? What's the impact on our local bat population, our local bird population? So, you know, there's this friction that's developing, I think, between environmental groups that are taking longer view and may be willing to sacrifice a few bats along the way, so to speak. And I don't mean to, you know, obviously I value endangered species values as much as anyone else, but we're in this trade-off now. We may have to sacrifice our sort of pure green, go all the way with environmental values in the short term in order to accomplish our long-term goals. It's a legal problem in the sense that the old green laws are sitting there waiting for any particular interest group that's, say, opposed to this infrastructure project, green or brown, to challenge it. So we have to think about the legal structure.
To get to the issue of trade-offs, what trade-offs do you see that we may have to make as we move forward?
Sure. Well, I think many of these are sort of the standard trade-offs that environmental law and natural resources law have had to make all along the way. I mentioned the short-term, long-term, right? So will we be willing to sort of scale back what we usually expect from an infrastructure project if it's one that is going to, in the long term, do more environmental good than bad in the short term? We are constantly dealing in the environmental law area with the sovereignty issue and the federalism issue, preemption issues. You know, who's in charge? So we point to the Texas wind experience as, you know, if centralized decision-making may actually be the right way to go, even though we oftentimes want to provide local input. That's going to be a real tension. We have, as well, a trade-off in terms of property rights. So just to kind of step back, this abstract reduce emissions X percent by this year, it's hard to then contextualize that. What does that actually mean? And solar and wind power facilities take up vastly more land than do coal and natural gas generation facilities. Plus, we're going to need to probably build tens of thousands of miles of new energy transmission lines, if Texas is any indication. And so we've got a property rights issue. And how will we deal with that? Will we use eminent domain to take land and pay just compensation? Will property rights advocates, as they have in many occasions, oppose that by opposing the environmental assessments and permitting processes so that their land can't be taken.
Sure. So I hear you mentioning several things, long versus short-term perspectives, taking into account a long-term perspective, property rights, anticipating these property rights conflicts, speed versus public participation,
right.
There's a bit of a trade-off there, and then the sovereignty trade-offs, which we might define as federal versus state governance trade-offs that we need to address. And this comes up in the context, I think, very clearly in permitting. It can come up in many instances. And the issue of simplifying permitting and streamlining it, which we mentioned earlier, it's not a new issue. The Obama administration itself had many proposals to try to streamline permitting to overcome some of these difficult challenges and tensions. And the Trump administration has attempted to streamline infrastructure permitting as well, simplifying the complex processes, shifting burdens of proof, and the like. You mentioned earlier that these kinds of reforms are not enough to fully address these trade-offs. Why not?
So I think what we need is a more consolidated approach, number one. I mean, not just tweaking NEPA, tweaking the Clean Water Act, tweaking the Clean Air Act with facilitation and streamlining. I mean, I think really we need to be able to identify the set of infrastructure that are within the sort of Green New Deal or green space, and design an environmental assessment and siting program for those at the federal level. The question then being, to what extent will that preempt state and local decision making, or can it incorporate some kind of state and local process, but not an independent, separate bite at the apple, so to speak? What we're driving at is, shouldn't NEPA also think about these impacts of the long-term impacts of green infrastructure? So, yes, this project may kill 26 bats. What does this project do to contribute to climate change mitigation, in which case it might be saving 500 bats?
Sure.
And that's the kind of question we are sort of asking here in this paper. And, you know, if NEPA wants us to consider the downstream impacts of burning the natural gas that the pipeline delivers, I think it also ought to make us ask, well, what are the long-term impacts of green infrastructure balanced against the short-term impacts that are the sort of core of NEPA? Environmentalists have been very good at focusing on the adverse downstream, adverse cumulative impacts. They haven't demanded that NEPA analysis consider these long-term benefits in the green infrastructure space.
You highlight in your paper the citizen participation versus speed trade-off. And this is a nice segue, I think, to some of the broader considerations you also bring to the fore in the piece, which are fairness and distributive justice concerns. How can we make these kinds of trade-offs while still making sure we're attentive to fairness and distributive justice concerns without giving these concerns the short shrift?
It's a great question. And let's back up a little bit. So there was a lot of infrastructure projects at national scale that our country succeeded in putting on the ground. And there's no question that many of these projects were not attended to distributive justice at all, or even environmental impact. The irony is that the environmental laws that we call the old green laws, they came online in the early 70s and really matured in the 80s, became this sort of arsenal to not to stop national infrastructure skeleton building, so to speak, but, you know, this little highway spur, that additional pipeline, etc. So we've never really pushed through a major national scale infrastructure project like the Green New Deal is asking us to do through the existing environmental laws. We don't know how messy that will be. I predict it would be extremely messy. The wild card here is, you know, we didn't have any particular timeline that the interstate highway system had to be completed, right? It wasn't an existential kind of proposition. We're being told, and I certainly believe the science on this, that we need to cut greenhouse gas emissions dramatically. So we don't have time to go through that kind of 20-year process to get a project completed. So the question there is, how do we compress that time frame on a national scale? It's not just one project, many, many projects, and recognize that we have to do a better job of you know, allowing people to have a voice and ensuring that we're just not, you know, steamrolling through vulnerable populations. I think we have to think system-wide and pull this together into really a national mobilization that requires a national law, where the extent to which that national law preempts other voices, state and local, that's something we're going to have to think about seriously. A lot of trade-offs ahead, a lot of serious thinking. It's great to have goals. It's great to know the numbers, this percent by that year. How we do it, it cannot be business as usual.
Well, thank you very much
thank
for
you,
taking the time to discuss this, and I look forward to seeing your article in print.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot.